You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, nō mai, hari mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wire Wharapa Wednesday. I'm your host Manny and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by Toby and later by our producer Theo. FI Akane coming up on the show for our weekly catch up with the Green Party. I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the budget, a controversial government law that empowers MSD to automate decision making, and how the government's climate policy is incurring costs. Toby, what do you have for us today?
Today I spoke to youth development worker Aaron Hendry about the growing issue of youth homelessness and what he argues is an inadequate level of support provided by the government in the recent budget. And what does Theo have for us?
Well, later in the show, Theo will speak to Victoria Coleman, whose petition is calling for the scrapping of the Disability Support Services Bill currently making its way through Parliament. And they also will speak to Honorary Professor Susan St. John on the recent child poverty report. Ha'aha o whakaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wariware, e ahei ana koutou, te whakarongo ki enei kōrero anō, hei pikihiri ruki ruki mā runga i te pai. Tuku tuku e rangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
It's budget week, and despite the modesty of this budget, the news cycle has been rolling in. Key to the budget is the gutting of the public service, with an additional 9,000 Kiwis working in government services set to be gone by 2029, on top of the thousands the government let go earlier this term. Seemingly as a part of this, the Social Security Modernization Amendment Bill will enable automated or robo-decision making within the Ministry of Social Development, taking humans out of benefits and disability payment decisions, a practice that came to a dark end in Australia, with many recipients wrongfully lumped with debt that the government eventually had to foot. Here in New Zealand, it is made even more alarming by being sped through Parliament under urgency, removing the oversight and guardrails that reforms would normally face. And if they will have to foot the bill in the long run, is the government really making the savings they claim? The Green Party wants to ask this question in regards to our climate commitments. They say that poor caretaking of our emissions trading scheme has led to the failure of several auctions of credits, leading the government to be over $1 billion behind and failing to meet our international commitments that will cost the country even more in the long run. So for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the budget. Do the numbers add up? And what are the consequences to cutting people out of the hard choices? Well, kia ora, Ricardo. How are you going this morning?
Kia ora. I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is our first interview since the budget was released, and so obviously we want to be touching on things in there. And then also there is the Social Services Amendment Bill that I would love to talk about later in the interview, but let's start off by talking about the budget. What were the things that jumped out to you this time around?
Yeah, look, if you look at the pre-budget announcements and the budget itself, it's really clear that this is a budget that's been balanced off the backs of low-income families. We've seen that because the government has chosen to take money from low-income homeowners. It has chosen to take money off state housing tenants. It has chosen to also, throughout this term, take money off low-income people who need borders. And at the same time, we keep being told there's not enough money for things like good public transport to end poverty, and yet there's clearly billions and billions of dollars for military equipment and cuts to landlords. This budget, in my view, will only leave the families that are struggling worse off and in a direction that clearly shows us no ambition for a New Zealand that actually addresses things like wealth inequality and crumbling infrastructure.
When you're talking about the negative impact to low-income families and people on welfare, it does make me think of the Social Security Modernization Amendment Bill. It sounds like it's going to open up the door for some amount of automation within how we run work and income. Maybe you can speak to this. What is this law enabling?
So the Green Party has been the only political party chasing the fact that the government throughout this term has been slowly expanding the use of automated decision-making. Automated decision-making is effectively decisions made by a machine instead of a human. And under this budget, they introduced a bill under urgency with no public scrutiny that would effectively allow MSB to be able to make any decision, exercise any power, and when I say any, it literally is how it's written, through the use of automated decision-making. And so what this could potentially pave the way is for any decision in a welfare system to be made by a machine instead of a human. And this matters because effectively, all the time, we've got people on welfare who need emergency assistance to be able to put food on the table, to keep a home, to, for example, be able to be well enough for a life-saving surgery. And the amount of help that can be delivered and whether people can even access that help or not often relies on human discretion. If you take that back and put it into a machine, you know that there's going to be errors, you know there's going to be biases, and the key thing is that you cannot really make a machine accountable for mistakes. And so you also take away the accountability that exists in systems where humans are able to run them and to be accountable for those systems as well. And we think that's a really dangerous precedent that the government is setting.
We saw some of the consequences of automated decision-making in the Australian welfare system, where numerous people who were receiving different benefits ended up being lumped with a lot of debt that was not actually theirs, really. This seems like there's all these problems that could arise from this. And obviously, there might be some world in which this could be managed correctly, but obviously that's one in which you'd be thinking through these problems and putting firm guardrails. How was this legislation passed, and do you feel like it gave enough focus, and was there time to scrutinise the problems that might arise from it?
I think a bill that allows MSD to use automation for any decision, any power, should have received adequate scrutiny at the Select Committee. This is not something that the National Party campaigned on, and it does risk creating a lot of problems if the safeguards and systems are not in place. As you mentioned, in Australia, through the use of RoboDebt, there were mistakes being made and people literally died as a result of the way that the system was set up. In Europe, for example, you saw the Dutch cabinet resigning over the use of an automated system and the welfare system that also caused disastrous consequences for people, and families were wrongfully accused of fraud. And so I think that this is a complete disregard for adequate scrutiny, for good democratic processes. And look, this is not about being against technology. This is actually simply about using automation responsibly. I think when it comes to decisions over people's livelihoods, I don't think that automation is the way forward because of that lack of accountability. And like I said, algorithmic decision-making can actually entrench biases that already exist and make it even harder for those to be addressed. And so we could see disabled people, Maori, low-income women being disproportionately negatively impacted by the use of algorithmic decision-making, which is another kind of effectively another term for automated decision-making. And again, you take away all the accountability. Like we're not the wiser about who effectively is accountable for mistakes being made through the use of automated decision-making.
With the Greens' response to the budget, I saw several mentions of the collapse of the emissions trading scheme. I wondered if you were in a position to talk about that a little bit and what it meant for this claim to be financially responsible.
Well, the government seems to want to have it both ways. They have both taken, they haven't taken action on climate change. They haven't invested in the things that we need to meet our climate obligations, but more than anything, to protect our communities against the impacts of extreme weather events. And this looks like, for example, the electrification of our transport system. This looks like making sure that we can solarize state homes, schools and hospitals. And this is now creating the conditions where we're not on track to meet our emissions trading scheme targets and Paris obligations. And effectively, what this means is that if the government doesn't meet them, we have to pay all this money offshore. And then the government, on top of that, on top of not meeting their climate obligations, has not budgeted enough to actually pay those credits offshore for failing to meet them, effectively creating a fiscal hole within the budget. This is irresponsible, but more than anything, it speaks of the government's lack of commitment to actually taking climate action onshore and simply either relying on sending money overseas or just forfeiting those obligations and creating a dangerous precedent where nations just stop, trying to actually do their part on meeting their climate change targets. And this will leave us all worse off and worsen the climate crisis as well as the cost of living crisis.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me this morning, Ricardo.
Thank you very much, Manuel. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March about the budget, a controversial government law that empowers MSD to automate decision-making, and how the government's climate policy is incurring costs that aren't being budgeted for.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
This is Tanuka-chan with Lazy Love. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
I try my best.
That was Kerosene by Yves Tumor, and before that was Lazy Love by Tanuki-chan. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. You can text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
According to a recent report by Community Housing Aotearoa, homelessness in this country has reached its highest level in history, with more than 50% of people experiencing homelessness being under the age of 24. People continue to die on the streets every year, and as we enter the winter months, the risks to people without a roof over their heads grows even more serious. To discuss the issue of youth homelessness in the context of the government's recent budget announcement, I spoke to Aaron Hendry, a youth development worker and advocate based in Auckland. Hendry works for the organisation Kickback, which runs an open space on K Road called The Front Door, providing shelter and essential services for young people in vulnerable situations. I was shocked to learn that over 50% of people experiencing homelessness in this country are under the age of 24. Is this normal among developed countries? And if not, what are the particular social factors that are driving youth homelessness in New Zealand?
It is not normal, and we need to be really clear on that. It's not normal for a society to have their children, their young people growing up in housing insecurity, homelessness. In the most extreme cases, literally sleeping on our streets. It's not acceptable, and we should never accept it within New Zealand society. In terms of some of those like driving factors, so why is it happening? I mean, it's really clear that it's been, you know, a long-term neglect from successive governments to, you know, adequately wrestle with the reality that in New Zealand we do not have the right to housing. So housing is largely seen as a commodity. It's not a protected human right in New Zealand, and that is having huge effects both on our community and our whānau. And so, you know, driving factors of tamariki, rangatahi homelessness, it's poverty. It's families struggling to get by. It's domestic violence. It's mental illness. It's addiction. It's the lack of whānau who are really struggling and trying to support their kids and trying to support themselves and just keep a roof over their heads. So there's massive challenges, and mostly when we kind of dig into it, a lot of these are systemic and structural challenges that exist because governments haven't done what they need to do to ensure that whānau have the support they need to adequately care for their kids.
Now, in terms of reversing homelessness, one of the approaches that's seen the most success in countries including Finland is what's called the Housing First model. So in simple terms, what is this model and what would it look like to implement it in this country?
Yeah, look, there is like a measure of Housing First operating in New Zealand. One of the real challenges is we do not have enough public housing in New Zealand to make that model really stick and to scale it to the level we really need to. Housing First basically starts at the basic premise that everyone deserves a home. Everyone deserves to be safe. Everyone deserves to have a place that is stable and that is safe for them to live in. And that we shouldn't be trying to force people to jump through 1,000 hoops before they can access housing. Housing is a basic human right. It's a basic human need. And all of our whānau, all of our kids need it. You know, in New Zealand, if we were going to really do that well, and there's support, there's agencies, there's community housing providers delivering this across the country, doing a great job. But if the government's really going to support it, they also need to back public housing. They need to ensure that we have a strong, you know, public housing build program, that we are backing public housing so that all of us can access safe and stable housing. And, you know, that's one of the challenges I think we have in New Zealand is that we're not truly investing in public housing, and this government has gutted public housing build programs. They've stalled public housing developments that had been kind of on the go, and we're seeing that in kind of the data and young people kind of increasingly becoming more vulnerable to homelessness.
Now, you mentioned that there are already a number of organisations that provide forms of housing and support, yet homelessness, and particularly youth homelessness, remains an acute problem. So is it that these organisations that currently exist just lack capacity, or are there other reasons why people experiencing homelessness, particularly young people, might be unable or unwilling to use the services offered?
Yeah, look, it's a multifaceted issue, right? So yes, on one side, agencies supporting whānau experiencing homelessness are at capacity and often overwhelmed. And so there's a huge need to invest in, again, public housing, community housing, ensuring that we have the housing necessary to support people and the support services in place. When we're talking about tamariki and rangatahi homelessness, there's also specific needs that some of our young people have, you know, for youth-specific opportunities. And so there's real gaps in terms of housing that young people can access. So if young people aren't able to live with their whānau, there's huge barriers to what they can access. There are some youth housing services that do a tremendous job, but they don't fit the needs of absolutely every young person. And for some young people, those youth housing services, you know, they can't get into because they don't meet the criteria, or, you know, their needs are too high because of the level of trauma and harm that they've experienced. And so
the government needs to have a real specific strategy to addressing and responding to youth homelessness. And part of that, again, it's public housing. You know, what young people say they need is shelter. They need a safe place to live, to even begin to heal, even begin to think about employment, about education. They need to be able to access housing without needing to jump through a thousand hoops or sign up to a COPPA or, you know, do X, Y, and Z if we're going to ensure that our young people are safe and stable. And so, look, that's a real kind of key. Alongside that, within that strategy, we need to be looking at all the systems that are failing our kids and ensuring that we're actually putting the resources necessarily into them. You know, for example, one like kind of key pipeline into homelessness right now is our health system, right? So young people are going to, you know, ED, to our emergency departments, really unwell, unsafe, and being discharged straight back into homelessness. So there's an opportunity where an intervention could be put in place, but we have not resourced that system to really understand the needs of the kids going there and then ensure that the support is in place to ensure that they're not going back onto the street. And, you know, if we look at our social safety net across the whole system, there's massive rips in it, rents in it, and our kids are slipping through the cracks. And, you know, our government needs to take a far more escalated approach to this. It's a growing crisis, and we're not responding at the pace necessary to ensure the safety of our children.
Lastly, would you like to tell us a bit about the work that the Front Door does in the community?
Kickback we're a youth development social change organisation. We started with young people basically saying, here's the gaps, here's what we need, and how do we build solutions. And so one of our kind of key services is the Front Door. It's a drop-in crisis response service for Tamariki Rangatai based on K Road, 307 K Road. Any young person or child can turn up if they're in crisis. So they need access to housing, food, clothing, mental health support. We'll do what we can to support them and get them the support that they need. Healthcare is a big part of that as well. Another one of our services is the safety net, supporting local communities to be part of the solution. You know, tapping into whānau who have a spare room and are willing to take a young person for a short period of time so that we can provide them the support that they need. You know, like kind of looking back towards the budget and kind of the gaps that we're seeing, one of the things we're really, really concerned about is we're coming into winter. And homelessness is dangerous, and it's unsafe for anyone, let alone a child or a young person. And through the Front Door, we're seeing more and more children, more and more young people coming through, some of them sleeping rough, others in really dangerous situations. And the outreach and response services are just not in place to support those kids. One of the challenges we really struggle with is the lack of safe, stable shelter. There's only two immediate housing services in the city that will take a child or a young person that are youth specific, and that's a real gap. We often find ourselves, you know, late on a Friday night trying to figure out how we can get a young person into a semi-stable place for the weekend or tonight just to keep them safe. And so the government needs to be investing in immediate housing services and ensuring we have the wraparound outreach response services necessary to really support these kids and ensure that, you know, this winter we don't have children and young people sleeping outside on our streets. I mean, I think just the last point is it's just been really clear that homelessness is possible to end. You know, homelessness is a problem we can solve. Again, kind of like, you know, reflecting back on the budget, there was a huge missed opportunity to start to lay the groundwork to end homelessness in Aotearoa. It has been one of the biggest issues over the last couple of years. It has been front of mind for many in our communities. We're seeing homelessness explode in our local city centres. It's escalating, and yet we haven't seen a response. And what we need to understand is that homelessness is a political choice. It is a decision that we're making through decisions like how we allocate our resources through our budget, through policy decisions, through legislation, that enables it to continue. If we wanted to really respond to youth homelessness within this budget, we would have invested in immediate housing services, we would have invested in outreach services, we would be, you know, kind of killing the move on bill and instead implementing a duty to assist to ensure that all young people, all whānau that go to Work and Income or any government agency experiencing homelessness get the support they need and that they're entitled to. We would be ensuring that Work and Income, we're not sanctioning people experiencing homelessness, and we roll back the emergency housing policy, and we'd be backing public housing and ensuring that we have the housing stock available to house our people and ensure that none of our kids, our young people, our whānau sleep on the street. And so, look, the kind of idea that homelessness is just with us and it's, you know, it's sad and we should do what we can, but we can't ever solve it. Like, that's just the myth. We totally can end homelessness. And if the last couple of years are anything to go by, we've seen how policy decisions and government choices have escalated this crisis. Well, the hope is that different choices can absolutely end it as well. And so, look, that's kind of to end. It's just remembering that we can solve this and we can end it.
That was Aaron Hendry from the youth development organisation Kickback.
This is Austerity Blues by CCTV. We'll be right back after this break.
Home again, sitting on a Saturday night.
That was Austerity Blues by CCTV. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395, or you can call us on 309-3879. I think it's time for Get Action.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
Last year, two parents who cared full-time for their disabled adult children were successful in being found by the Supreme Court of New Zealand to be recognised as employees of the government. They were seeking the better pay and protections afforded through this status as they carried out skilled and demanding work requiring a 24/7 commitment. The court noted that the parents were undertaking work that the Ministry of Social Development would be obligated to do itself were the parents to refuse or be unable to do the work. The finding opened the door for other family carers to be entitled to protections such as being paid minimum wage. However, last month, the government announced that it would be passing legislation to put a stop to the approximately 45 similar claims currently in the courts, as well as any future claims, alongside a fundamental shift in how disability support services function. The Minister for Disability Issues, Louise Upston, says that the bill aims to clarify the structure of disability support services and makes clear that the policy intention was never for family carers to be considered employees of the government. While the Minister has said that there are better ways to recognise such carers, no plans have yet been put forward. Members of disabled communities have expressed great concern at the implications of the bill, which goes far beyond mere clarification of the structuring of disability support services. So, for this week's Get Action, I spoke with Victoria Coleman on her petition to scrap the Disability Support Services Bill currently making its way through Parliament.
Kia ora, Victoria. So I think, first of all, it would be helpful to outline what disability support services currently look like, particularly from your own experience. So what kind of support does the government currently provide in terms of funding, compensation or assistance?
Thanks, Theo. Thanks for having me on. It's currently a real mishmash. It is very patchy. It depends. It's quite hard to actually find the system structure, how it works. Everybody's getting something different. It's just a very difficult, broken system right now.
So from afar, the legislation broadly looks to overrule last year's Supreme Court decision that found that family members caring for disabled people should be considered employees of the state and so are entitled to the relevant benefits and protections. It also looks to clarify, according to the words of the Minister, the structure of disability support services. However, there are a lot of other far-reaching points in the legislation that you've pointed out in your recent press release. Could you speak to some of those implications that have come up?
Sure. So for us, there is nothing that clarifies anything in that bill at all. Not one single point clarifies anything for the disabled community, the disability community. It clarifies things for the Crown and it pushes away their responsibilities. So they are going to legislate that we are not their employees, even though the court said we are. They're going to legislate that our disabled person is our employee, even when they're not capable. Even when they're not capable of being that. And basically, they have used the employment issue as a smokescreen to hide behind it many different nasty points, which will strip away any sort of any ability to be independent and safe and comfortable and plan for a future. It will give the government almighty power through secondary legislation. That could be anything. So the community's just terrified, to be honest.
Now, a recent press release by the Disability Issues Minister, Louise Upston, claims that the proposed legislation will help to make disability support services clearer and easier to navigate, saying that the bill sets out what the disability support system does, its purpose, and how public funding can be used. The Minister emphasises the need for a fair, clear, and simple disability system. However, the regulatory impact statement for the bill focuses primarily on the fiscal risk or impact of the court finding in outlining the need for the legislation. Essentially, the risk that it's going to end up costing the government a lot of money. How would you characterise the government's approach and motivations with this bill?
The motivation is definitely minimisation of cost, minimisation of disabled people. The bill doesn't clarify anything. It doesn't improve anything. It actually gives them the ability to minimise everything. It pushes everything onto the families. It says they basically will take no responsibility and you'll get what you're given if you're lucky. It's not an entitlement. You're not, as a citizen of this country, if you end up disabled or with a disabled whānau member, there is no protection that there will be help for you.
And how is that feeling for you in being someone who receives the supposedly support from the system? How has the government's approach felt?
Absolutely terrifying. We spend our entire lives scared anyway. We spend our entire lives fighting to try and just live a normal life as best we can and have independence and be able to plan for a future. And every time we look around, the government is harming us again. They're pulling something out from under us. It's just... We have no ability to feel secure.
And was any consultation done with the disabled community for this bill?
Those of us living in it are not aware of any consultation that has been done. I believe if there's been any done, it's been with organisations who are probably funded by the government. Nobody that I have spoken to is living with disability has been consulted.
So ideally, what would you like to see the government do in this space? Would reverting this legislation so that we're back to where we were a month ago be adequate? Or would you like to see further work around how disability support and services are provided?
There definitely needs to be system reform. The system needs to be fair. Families are being punished currently for caring for their own disabled person. They are being driven into poverty and they're being harmed by a system that breaks them. So work needs to be done. But rushing something through like this that has such massive human rights implications right before an election is completely unacceptable. The Ministry of Justice has already advised the Attorney General that this bill does discriminate on the basis of disability, as well as on family status and marital status. But then they have said that this is justified. When is it ever justified for our government to discriminate against a minority group?
Can you speak a bit more on those challenges that families are currently facing or that you think will get even worse with this bill?
Navigating the system right now is nearly impossible. I mean, the amount of administrative work just to have access to the funding, the hoop jumping, the constant And then once you actually have funding, actually using it is incredibly difficult. And that, you know, you've seen over the past couple of years how complex that has been made. 2 years ago, they ripped the rug out from under us and just said, you can't do anything with your funding except for a couple of things, you know. So people had lives, they had independence, they were doing things one day, and the next day, a lot of people couldn't even leave their house. Then they've also cut, you know, access to transport, lottery grants for individual vehicles. We're moving away from independence and autonomy for disabled people.
And I imagine the finding of the Supreme Court case last year probably provided a bit of hope for the community. Were you feeling kind of optimistic when that came out?
Yeah, I saw that as a massive opportunity for the government to go, okay, the system's been broken for 30 years. We've been harming people. Let's sort that out. Now, if everyone can't be an employee of the state, which is understandable, the system needs to be fair because the system is harming people. So they missed that opportunity and they decided to exert power over a vulnerable group of people. It's just heartbreaking to live in a country that would do that to us.
And while the bill isn't going through urgency, they've truncated the select committee stage so that it's much shorter. I mean, how would you characterise that move by the government?
I would characterise it as absolutely disgusting. As we talked about earlier, when you're responding to something from an inclusion and disability perspective, the right thing to do would be to provide more time. Our community needs more time because we have more challenges, right? And so they have truncated that to ensure that we don't have time to respond to it. It's just, it's heartbreaking.
So as the Human Rights Commission points out, and you just mentioned before, this comes after Kāinga Ora dropped its annual targets for creating accessible homes. Financial subsidies for the Total Mobility Scheme were reduced. The Lottery Grants Board has ceased funding for lottery individuals with disabilities. And the government has recently passed legislation that's going to automate parts of the New Zealand welfare system, which, of course, would include the disability allowance. Do you think that New Zealand is taking the rights of disabled people seriously?
Not at all. Not at all. I think that from my perspective, it looks like they are trying to exterminate all rights of disabled people. Just extinguish them, take them away, and we have to, you know, just be grateful for being allowed to exist, basically.
So in regard to your petition, you've put forward a petition that would call for us to repeal this legislation. How is that petition doing so far?
We're heading towards 7,000 signatures, which is a pretty strong response for a week and a half that it's been up on an active bill. I think that's going to come in really strong. But we've just got to keep pushing it. We've got to do our submissions. We've got to turn up at Parliament. So the 2nd of July, there's an event set up to hand over the petition. This is an all-of-government bill, and this government have almighty power. And they've basically just said they will do as they please regardless. So, you know, we've got very little means to push back.
That was Victoria Coleman on her petition to scrap the Disability Support Services Bill, currently making its way through Parliament. If you'd like to sign the petition, you can find it on the Our Action Station website or through the link we'll include in the description of this interview on our BCast page.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
Under the Public Finance Act, the government is required to release a report on child poverty as part of the budget process. The report for 2026, released last week, shows that New Zealand is far from on track to meet its goal of reducing child poverty to 6% by 2028. One of the key measures of this, material hardship, was not even able to be estimated by the Treasury, but was calculated to be sitting at 14.3% in the financial year 2024 to 2025. With community providers, such as food banks, reporting increased hardship in the community, it seems highly unlikely that the government will meet previous targets for reductions in child poverty. So, to speak on the government's approach so far and what the recent child poverty report tells us, I was joined by Honorary Associate Professor at the University of Auckland, Susan St. John. Kia ora, Professor Susan St. John. So, first of all, I guess I'll start with the big question. Are we taking child poverty seriously in this country?
Well, if you looked at the child poverty report and the budget, you'd have to say that we are not, that it has been downplayed considerably. In fact, there's almost no emphasis on it at all in the budget. So it's of great concern that something in the Act called Child Poverty Reduction Act, that obliges government to report on progress in achieving goals on reducing child poverty and to set up plans of what it's going to do and how it's going to reach the goals in the future, that's all just been bypassed in this budget.
I mean, what does that tell us about the legislation, I guess, that we've got in place, that all this can be just bypassed? I mean, is this telling us that we need some stronger safeguards in place to make child poverty reduction a priority?
Well, it was a very hard-fought event to get that Act passed with bipartisan support. The problem is that this government doesn't believe that the solutions to child poverty require it to do anything, except, as they say, to get the economy growing, because it's going to solve child poverty. Well, that's no answer at all. So it's a fundamental problem with the underlying different ideology here, I think. And I don't know how you... The Act was celebrated as something that really was going to make sure that children were no longer invisible, that their needs were prioritised and that everybody was on the same page. Well, have we failed there, and what would be a new model? I don't know.
Now, you mentioned in your Substack article that the budget lays out 10 priorities. Did child poverty make it into that list?
Well, not at all, not even mentioned. And the first priority was to get fiscal balance and to reduce public debt. Well, that is a very arid aspiration, in my view. And if you're going to get the economy growing, you need a healthy and well-supported, growing young population who will contribute to the workforce. And what that is, we're going in exactly the opposite direction. We're creating more ill health amongst the young, more mental depression, more sense of hopelessness, lack of educational achievement. All of the negative things we're achieving are going to make the economy worse, not better.
Now, I'm just going to read out from the report. It has a section mentioning Budget 2026 initiatives that can have an effect on the level of child poverty. And I'll just get your opinion on what you think this overall kind of means for child poverty. I'll just read them out now. So there's going to be increased rent that will need to be paid by people in social housing. The accommodation supplement will increase by $10 and $30 per week. There is the $50 per week fuel in-work tax credit. There will be a reduction in the max RTE for temporary additional, or the max rate, sorry, for temporary additional support from 30 to 25%. Now, that's supposedly to offset high inflation, creating increases to the weekly hardship payments. But I'll just note that the government early in its term tied benefits to the CPI rather than wage growth. They've also mentioned that there'll be between 1.6 and 2.5 additional state houses, greater employment support for sole parents, continuing the school health or the school food program, and there'll be more support, or there'll be ongoing support to food banks. Now, looking at those initiatives, what kind of picture do you think that paints?
Well, many of the things that you've read out are actually negative for child poverty, and some of the things that might look positive and are spun to look positive are very dubious indeed. For example, the case management of sole parents at $93 million for the next 2 years to get them off the benefit and into work, because work is the solution to their poverty, and the optimistic costing of what they think they're going to save by doing that is very questionable. But just to think about one or two of the things that you've mentioned, there's the fuel subsidy, $50 of the in-work tax credit that they're pointing to, and then they go on to say that it is because of that that they can show that there is a slight reduction in the income measure of child poverty for the next year after the Treasury have modelled this. But that's very, very cynical, because it's a temporary measure, and that $50 only goes to a very select group of families who happen to not be on any benefit of any kind. And it is a payment for children, but it manages to leave out 250,000 or so of the most needy children.
And I suppose it also neglects the, I guess, stimulus for the fuel subsidy payment, in that there is this increased hardship because of the current fuel crisis. So to present it as improving the situation rather than potentially bringing the situation back to the baseline where it was before the fuel crisis starts out, seems a bit disingenuous.
You've absolutely nailed it there. It's actually got nothing to do with a desire to decrease child poverty, or nor will it have a meaningful impact on actual child poverty. As you say, it is to compensate certain families, narrowly defined, for the fuel price increase.
So how are we measuring child poverty? Or how is the government measuring child poverty? And does that mesh with what we're seeing out in the community?
Well, it's difficult to measure child poverty, and the surveys on which the figures are based are always a bit out of date. So we don't actually have the current situation reflected in the last child poverty figures that we have, and it's difficult to model it going forward as to what will be the picture in the future. In the Act, there are 10 measures. There are four top measures, of which three are the ones that are concentrated on. Maybe just briefly talking about the first one, which is material hardship. It's the proportion of children found to be in material hardship based on the fact that they don't have access to a range of absolute basics for their well-being. Now, if we look at what the figures are showing us, that rate of child poverty has been climbing in the last couple of years. It did come down a little bit in the early 2020s under the Labor government policies, but we're going in the wrong direction, and there is absolutely nothing in this budget to suggest that that trend upwards will be decreasing in any meaningful way. So that's all very discouraging, and quite a disgrace for a developed country to be in this situation.
So what do you think that we need to be doing. Now, recently over the weekend, the finance minister in an interview mentioned that while we could double benefits, which would have a big impact on reducing child poverty, it wouldn't be in the fiscal interest of the country, for example. What would you propose that we do?
Well, one of the things that we could do is to fix working for families so that the in-work tax credit part currently doesn't go to the very poorest children. It's an obvious thing to do. We should transfer the in-work tax credit into the family tax credit, which does go to all children. And by doing that, you would be providing nearly 100 or 150 under the current policies extra to the very worst off families. And there are other things that we should be doing with working for families. But it's not only improving incomes, it's obviously making sure that the minimum wage is adequately adjusted, making sure that there isn't harsh clawbacks when people earn a little bit of extra income, making sure that housing is suitable and affordable, and a raft of other things, of course, that need to underpin a serious approach to reducing measures like the material hardship measure.
And I mean, has there been any work on a more long-term plan to reduce or hopefully eradicate child poverty?
I can't see it under this government at all. There is nothing in the pipeline to suggest that they believe that improving incomes at the lower end is something that will help child poverty and is what they're committed to doing. Quite the reverse, as you could hear in what the minister said on the Q&A program. So doubling benefits would reduce child poverty, but implicitly she is saying that wouldn't be very good for the family because they would then become dependent on benefits or dependent on the state. So it's not seeing it at all from the lens of the poor child who doesn't have proper clothing in the middle of winter or doesn't have access to good food, fresh fruit, vegetables, and can go to the doctor when needed because the parents can afford to drive the car. None of those issues cross her mind. It's all about achieving some sort of fiscal outcome, which of course is based on priorities. What actually does matter to this government? And you'd have to say it's protecting the top end of the income and wealth distribution.
That was Honorary Associate Professor at the University of Auckland, Susan St. John, on the recent child poverty report released by the government.
This is Foreign Agent by Gnomes. This is 95 BFM.
Thank you.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki, ei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e koro mai ki mātou mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests who joined us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Kickback's Aaron Hendry, campaigner Victoria Coleman, and honorary associate professor at the University of Auckland, Susan St. John. Nei rā hoki, te mihi, ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4th Bridge. See you next week.
That was The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.